This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency, with information for IT professionals. For more information and to download other shows, visit ciaops.podbean.com. This is episode 18 with Josh Peterson and is sponsored by Applied Marketing Technologies, the leaders in the Australian market for customer relationship management and small business networks. Visit them on the web at www.amt.com.au. Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and in this episode, we're joined by Josh Peterson from the Taylor Business Group. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, good morning, Robert.
How are you going?
Very good, thank you. How about yourself?
Not too bad, considering. As we like to do here on the podcast, what I'll get you to do is just firstly introduce yourself to our listeners and also give us a bit of a background on the business that you're involved with.
Oh, gladly. Thank you for the opportunity to join you. Yeah, my name is Josh Peterson. I'm a senior consultant with the Taylor Business Group. We've been with the Taylor Business Group for about 7 years now, and Taylor Business Group has been around for about 10 years now. At the Taylor Business Group, we like to call ourselves an MSP or VAR-centric consulting firm. We are very operationally focused on improving the net operating profit of your business. So specifically, we're trying to get more money to the bottom line through improving sales process, service delivery, and apropos of today's conversation, your accounting practices.
How many groups do you have, you know, under your wing, and sort of how far do they stretch? Obviously, I mean, I know there are some groups out here in Australia, but can you give us an idea of sort of, you know, the breadth of the Taylor Business Group?
Sure, of course. Taylor Business Group engages their clients in three specific manners. One of them is through our workshops. We've got five specific workshops spreading everything from sales management, service management, training salespeople how to sell in a managed services or an IT field. And then specifically, there's one for owners. It's kind of an overview of all the things that we need to be paying attention to as owners. And then we have another workshop for hiring practices. The second way that we engage our clients is through our direct one-on-one consulting. And that's where we're best known for. We typically have about 65 direct clients at any given time. And we spend just about every working day of the year in our clients' businesses, face-to-face, working with them on operational issues. And then, as you alluded to, we have our own peer groups called business improvement groups in Taylor Business Group language. And of those groups, I believe we have about 14 groups right now. And we have a majority of them here in the United States. Sometimes they're paired with specific products. We are a product neutral company just because we are consultants, so we don't endorse any products. However, certain vendors will ask us to make a group specifically for them. For example, we have Autotask groups that are made up of just Autotask users. We have some Enable groups that are just Enable users. But a majority of our groups are vendor neutral, where they're not tied to any vendors. So I believe we, like I said, we have 13 to 15 groups right now, I believe. We have them in London, Australia, and then also in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good. Like I said, there is a, I know a number of people out here have been involved in the Taylor Business Groups, and they speak very highly of it. So I think it's, again, a great way to improve your business and obviously link up and network with peers as well, which is, you know, something that's very important to the smaller man operations generally these days.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the major topics you wanted to speak about today was obviously the importance of a proper P&L chart of accounts and how you go about achieving that. So do you want to give us a bit more of an idea of what you're talking about there?
Oh, by all means. When we talk about the profit and loss statement, we're really talking about the scorecard of your business. Doesn't necessarily relate to how much cash we have in our pocket or how much money's left at the end of the year, but it's a scorecard that tells you how well you're performing operationally. And it's such an important report from your accounting package, but it's one that's so often overlooked. When we talk to our clients or our people that we begin working with, we hear that they look at their P&L, but they don't exactly know what they're looking at. So we try to break that down, and a large majority of our time spent with clients is on getting that chart of accounts into something meaningful. So often, the end user or client will use maybe the suggested chart of accounts from their accounting package or something from their accountant, which is all well and good. It's a great starting point, but we have our own very specific chart of accounts that allows you to get a very clear and concise view of the profitability and spend in the different areas of your business.
Okay, so obviously it's a case that most people that you come across are already going to have a chart of accounts, I would assume. It's a matter of, are you suggesting that they replace their chart of accounts with what your example one here, or do you think that's a bit of merging the two together?
You know, depending on the severity of their P&L or their interest level in their P&L, it could go either way. When we come across some people, they are very in tune to their P&L, and they have some very specific granularity to the P&L. And in that case, we don't really want them to change. What we suggest is that monthly they recast their P&L into a spreadsheet that matches something like ours. So they may have some very specific reasons for some of the granular things they're looking at, but it doesn't give them some of the key benchmarks that we're looking for in terms of easy viewing and easy reporting. Now, in other cases, we look at the P&L. There's no specific or particular attachment or emotional attachment to the P&L or the chart of accounts. So we say, let's just pump ours in there. It's very easy to import it using an Excel spreadsheet, and they're good to go. And then we can either assist them in transferring over balances from the previous accounts, or they can kind of start fresh. So either way is fine, but getting them in that view is very important.
So would you say that the majority of people that you deal with, or that you go to with the chart of accounts, are they financially savvy? Do they understand their P&L? Do they understand the financial side of their business? Or are they mainly just techies who, like you said, have just taken an example chart and just work with that?
Right. I would have to say it's the latter, where they're not necessarily financially savvy. They look at the P&L just enough to make sure that things are being billed for properly and that they have some idea of how much they're spending in certain areas. So alongside of that, mechanical use of a new P&L, we spend a lot of time training our clients and users on exactly what they are looking at and what it all means. So,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously you've got some very specific, the way that the chart's set up very specifically. Do you want to give us some idea as to why it's set up that way? Why do you, why is it important to set it up in the example way that you've got? I mean, what's the end result that the business owner is going to see if they implement this sort of chart of accounts?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. And let me start with just painting a visual picture of our chart of accounts. What a user would notice first is that it's broken down into, I believe, four very distinct sections. We want hardware and software to be categorized on its own. Then we also want service revenues to be categorized and service cost of goods sold, meaning the salaries and the expenditures that go along with employing somebody in the service department. Then we break it down into the sales expenses, both salaries, commissions, and any marketing or advertising that we do. And then in the fourth section, we have your administrative or general administrative expenses all lumped together so that you can see what is my gross profit on hardware and software without being muddied up with other expenses or revenues. And I specifically want to see in our service department who the people are that are being paid, how much they're being paid, and some key ratios alongside that. When we get down to the sales, we do want to specifically look and see what does our client acquisition cost us? How much are we spending on paying these salespeople to bring us new clients or service the existing clients?
Okay, just going to say, what about the growth of the cloud services? Do you see that just as a service revenue? I mean, there's the Microsoft model gives you some commissions for that. Is that sort of incorporated in the chart there? Is that something that needs to be broken out, do you think?
Yes, by all means. And cloud revenue is very interesting in its impact to the P&L. What we've seen with our larger clients who have really embraced the cloud or hardware as a service, they have a lot more balance sheet transactions than they do P&L transactions, because then we start getting some assets on the books in some cases. If we're owning that equipment, if we're leasing that equipment ourselves, we see a little different use of the balance sheet, which is a great conversation for another time. But yes, we are doing more tweaking to that P&L chart of accounts than we ever have in the past, because we do have more people utilizing cloud services and reselling cloud services. So we do have another category that we add for those folks, because that is typically, from an accounting standpoint, it is hard to tell. Is that a product or is that a service? Especially if we're reselling somebody else's cloud services. So we have to account for those margins differently, because hopefully those are a higher margin option, and we don't want to necessarily skew or inflate the view of a margin from another area of the business. So great observation about the cloud.
Okay, so is there anything you've talked about? Obviously, the P&L. What about the balance sheet? Do you do the same sort of thing with the balance sheet?
Yeah, balance sheet setup is a lot easier in the U.S. and probably worldwide. There are some generally accepted accounting principles. In the U.S., we call that GAAP accounting. So on the balance sheet, the accounts are much more specific and much more generalized. Well, that's a contradiction. They're much more generalized and specific to your accounting package. So there's not a whole lot of tweaking that we need to do there. But we do speak to the balance sheet when it comes to accounts receivables and growing the value of your business as well.
Okay. So again, the P&L obviously is the key component, and one of the key components of obviously if you're rearranging or optimizing the P&L is that you're looking for key ratios or key figures that you can break out and use a comparison. What are some examples of those key benchmarks that you're now looking for?
Great. Let's go through that. So let's start with a real easy one to measure, but it has its own subtle complexities. It would be the gross profit on hardware and software sales. We're looking to get 18% gross profit at a minimum on hardware sales. Now, hardware takes a bad rap in the general discussion of our IT businesses. But I can tell you that I just got back from Australia a couple of weeks ago with a group of 10 IT owners, and not a single one of those guys had less than 22% gross profit on hardware. Now, that's amazing. That's a great margin, and I don't know why anyone would complain about that. So where the complexity comes in is in the good accounting practice of when do we enter that invoice from our vendor, and how do we match that up with when we invoice our client so that we can get a real dollar for dollar comparison? If I pay for something, or if I get invoiced for something in January, but I don't bill for it until February, that can throw my numbers off. And as busy as many of these IT owners are, that lag can oftentimes occur. So we go very specifically into how do we start tightening up our process of getting invoices in and getting invoices back out the door in the same accounting cycle, so that we can see what our true gross profit on hardware is.
So along with the P&L side of it and the financial discipline of getting the right figures, do you also help, I suppose, coach people in the fact of explain to them the importance of, like I said, sitting down, dedicating a block of time every week, every day to doing these accounts, getting them, getting the invoices out, chasing up the money, banking the money, that side of it as well? Because I think that the experience would be is that, being most resellers are very good at the technical side. They love the technical side. They would take that above and beyond everything. The accounting side is boring and it's, a pain in the butt. They don't want to do it, but it's it's where you get your money from, strangely enough. But and I think a lot of them put that to the side. I'll get to that. And then, they end up, when tax time comes, being overwrought by it and, totally distraught. I mean, is it something that you would coach people as well, that it's something that needs to be done, regularly?
By all means. And you know, over the years of being a management consultant, especially in this industry, I'm finally getting it through my thick head to stop trying to shove a square peg into a round hole. So these guys, you know, if they don't want to do the accounting or the bookkeeping, great, don't do it. But let's hire somebody to do it. Okay, I'm perfectly okay with them not embracing and wanting to do it. But one of the first things I'd recommend is let's get you a proper part-time bookkeeper that comes into your office and is focused on your books. And please, for the love of all things holy, don't hire your spouse to do these things. Okay, let's get a professional in. Your spouse is probably phenomenal at it, but let's be honest, they don't want to do it either.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the general rules I would have is that, you know, it's very hard to separate personal from business. And I said, having a bookkeeper that's paid to do X job and doesn't have that, you know, complication can make things a bit easier. I know it's obviously a temptation to save a few bucks and do it that way and get someone you know to do it. But at the end of the day, I think if you're a professional and you're running a business, you need to treat it, you know, as an operational expense, and then you'll get the best results out of it, I believe, anyway.
Yes, my experience tells me that's very, very true. So I would agree with you 100%.
Okay, so we've got that first ratio that you mentioned. What else are we looking for? What other sort of key indicators are we looking for?
Sure. Well, we'll do an easy one, and we'll get some more complicated ones. But when I start working with a company, one of the very first numbers I look for is the service department gross profitability. And I'm taking all the service revenue, not the hardware and software, the service revenue, be it from break fix, be it from managed services, be it from online backups, whatever the service revenue is, I take all of that, and then I also lay underneath it any cost of services sold. How much did my employees' salaries cost in that department? How much did I pay for training my guys? How much did I pay for my PSA, whether it's ConnectWise or Autotask or TigerPaw? What did I pay for these things? And I allocate a portion of all of those expenses into the service department as necessary. I'm also going to put the cost of any licenses that I have, whether it's my Enable or any other, my antivirus or spam. I'm going to put all those costs in there. I'm going to take all the revenue, subtract all the costs, and I'm going to get a raw number. I'm then going to divide that raw number by the revenue of that department, and I'm going to get a gross profit percentage. And the percentage that I have to have is 55%. I need that to be 55%, because with that 55%, now I have to start paying all my bills. I have to start paying for salespeople if I have them. I have to start paying my rent, my electricity, my cell phone, that fancy car I bought. I need that to be at 55%.
And so, can I just ask how did you come around the figure of 55%?
Sure. What we have done is, over the course of the last 10 years, we have set a goal. And the goal that we have for all of our clients and anybody in this industry is a minimum of an 8.5% net operating profit. And I have to say that again very clearly, a minimum of 8.5% net operating profit. Okay. Having that number, we then work backwards and say, in order to achieve that, what kind of G&A expenses can we afford to have? What kind of sales expenses can we afford to have? And what sort of service gross profitability do we need to have in order to achieve that 8.5%? We then, over the last 10 years, overlaid that projection with all of the data we collect from clients and other people willing to share their numbers with us to see what's realistic. And what we found is our high-performing clients are going to hit that in the 60s and the 70s. When we first start working with some customers or some clients in the beginning, however, they're in the 30s and 35s and 40s. Now, I will say, we've tweaked it over the years, but when it comes to service gross profit, in any service-related or professional service-related industry, somewhere between 50 and 70% across industries is what we find. So it's not just specific to our industry, it's service-based industries.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's a good benchmark for people to aim at. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, within that growth and within that service GP number, there's a very, very important number that we have to be aware of. And that is the ratio between service salaries and service revenue. Okay? We're looking for a maximum of 33% of our service revenue going to our service salaries. Now, let's qualify that a little bit. If you are just running with nothing but engineers, no dispatcher, no service manager, no ancillary support in that department, we need to be under 33%. We need to be in that 25, 27%. Because eventually, I need you to get a dispatcher. Eventually, I need you to get a service manager. And if we're maxing out at 33% just on service staff, we're going to have a hard time finding the dollars to pay those support staff that hopefully will make our lives a little bit easier, because we won't have to do that aspect of the job anymore, or that aspect of ownership anymore. Okay, so that service salaries to service revenue needs to be 33%. Service gross profit, we're looking at it being 55%.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so again, I think the key indicators that you're looking for, and if you're dealing with people and you've put this in place and you've calculated the ratios that you've got there, and somebody's not up to that level, what do they start? Do they need to start making radical changes to their business? What's the next step after you're looking at the figures and saying we've measured this, we you're not achieving the levels that you should be. What's sort of the next step for them?
Yeah, where we go from there is we look at the 55% and say, okay, are you hitting it or are you not hitting it? If you're not hitting it, we dig a little bit deeper and say, where within your expenses, your cost of services sold, are we falling down? But there's a step that we take before that. We hear a lot of people talking about pure play managed, that they're a pure play managed service provider, or they're a pure play cloud provider, or whatever they are. If they're not hitting that minimum 55%, what we do is we look historically, we say, well, let's run that P&L for a year ago. Let's run it for 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago and see where you were before you adopted this new business model that you're trying out. And we try to see, is it better off or is it worse off? And then that can make a compelling discussion about why we chose that business model and what efficiencies we've gained or haven't gained. But coming back to the immediate question of what do we do to correct it, typically we look at service salaries, and we have to answer one of several questions. The two most obvious are, do we have too many people, or are we overpaying our people? So, and that's, that's a tough question to answer, especially for some of our smaller clients who hired somebody, they've been with them forever, they've been with them since day one. We feel like they deserve that super high salary, but our service revenues don't support it. So we have to then say, do we have a service-related issue or do we have a sales-related issue? Okay, if we're busy, if the guys are maxed out, if they're 70, 80, 90% utilized, but our service ratios are out of whack, we have to then look at our pricing and say, are we priced appropriately for what it costs us to deliver these services? Or do we not have enough work to keep these guys busy? And then we have to take some approaches to say, what's our plan moving forward? Do we need to bring on a salesperson to help us grow this business to support these service salaries that we're paying? And in very few cases, we're not the type of consulting firm that takes the easy answer of your service salaries are out of whack, you need to fire somebody or reduce salaries. We try to go a little bit deeper. We don't believe that you're ever going to cost cut your way to profitability, or wealth.
What about the situation where you've got somebody who wants to grow? So let's take an extreme, which is probably, I think, the majority of resellers. Is there a small one man, maybe two man operation? They're doing well. They're hitting their ratios as you're talking about, but they're looking to go to the next step, and you're hiring a service manager, hiring another tech. Do they base that on the figures? Obviously that helps, but is it also a feel as well that they think they're going to grow their revenue, or do they look again at the sales and try and bump that up to a certain level and then say, right, now we've got the level that we can support bringing someone in? I mean, do the figures in the P&L, are they a major decision point for, expanding your business if that's the way you want to go?
I believe so. And it, you know, when we're in that one or two and even three man shop, it is more difficult to use the P&L as your sole guidepost to the decision of hiring or not hiring or how to grow. But I would certainly hope that it is one of the factors you look at. Now, when you're just a little bit larger, or even when you're that size, but especially when you're a little bit larger, what I really need to see is this staff maxed out? And I'm not one of those guys that believes that it's a great thing to have my engineers 100% utilized and burning them out and working 20 hours of overtime a week. I want these guys. I want to see consistent utilization in the 70s and 80s, week after week, month over month, before I'm going to before I want to bring somebody on. So I'm going to look at a couple of factors there. So if I feel like I'm growing, if I feel like there's an opportunity that's about to max out my engineering time, I'm going to overlay that with some hard numbers, both from my PSA and from my, my P&L.
Okay. So again, I think it's a case of what you're saying is that, you know, there is, you know, the owner of the business knows their, hopefully knows their business better than anybody else and hopefully knows what's coming down the track. But obviously at the end of the day, there needs to be some hard numbers, some hard measurement facts that you can go back to and point and say, look, yes, I feel more comfortable backing my gut decision here, or you know, this is the right time to do it, or maybe the numbers indicate that I need to optimize or tweak something a little bit more before I go to that, you know, that next stage. So I think that in your experience, is that generally something that a lot of people in the business do, or are they just running on their gut instincts and obviously maybe getting into trouble down the track, do you feel?
Yeah, sadly, it's running on gut. And, you know, at some point they have some major event, whether it's the lack of ability to make payroll for that, that month, or the inability to, you know, pay themselves that month before they'll actually start looking at the numbers a little more critically. So we go with gut as long as we can. But eventually we have something occur in our business that makes us say, let me start understanding my numbers a little bit better.
Okay, so you've got your numbers. What's your recommendation on how often should I be looking at these numbers? Or, you know, is it every day? Is it every week? You know, is it something that I need to be constantly in the top of my mind? How often do I need to revisit this, in your opinion?
You know, I like to compare it to anybody who's ever tried to lose a pound or two. Okay, you can weigh yourself every day, okay, and you can look at the micro adjustments that occur every single day, but really we're not focusing on our whole life picture when we do that. So to look at the P&L every day or to look at it every week, we kind of get lost in the minutia of it, and if we're really obsessing over it, it really doesn't do us much good. What I would want is for a P&L review day or time every single month. So whether it's the 10th of every month, so we make sure that the previous month is closed, or whether it's the first Wednesday of every month, I need that to be a pillar of your week. That on this day, I spend 2 hours going over the P&L, and here's the important thing. I need to compare it to the months past so I can see trends, so I can see differences. Two things are going to happen when I look at it month over month. One, I'm going to spot accounting errors. If my cell phone bill was $400 last month and suddenly it's $900 this month, I'm going to find that accounting error instantly. Second thing that's going to occur is I'm going to start seeing trends in my income and my expenses. Okay, if I suddenly, you know, if I see that, you know, I was at $17,000 a month of managed services revenue last month, now I'm at $15,400. What happened? Did somebody not pay their bill? Did I lose a client? What happened? And I get an immediate snapshot view of action items for me to take care of.
Okay. And I think, I suppose, you know, transitioning into the second topic that we'll cover here, is it something that, you know, you've got your figures and, you know, you're a bit insulated, you're looking at your own business, you're looking at the numbers that you've given us, but what's the benefit of comparing those numbers to your peers, or comparing those numbers to, you know, bigger people or people or businesses you aspire to be, you know, in your immediate, you know, industry? Is that something that's just as important?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's obviously self-serving for me to say that, but I just believe it wholeheartedly from sitting with hundreds of companies every year in these groups to see that light bulb go on. You know, at the beginning of the call, I mentioned, you know, the service, I'm sorry, the product gross profitability, hardware, software, GP. There's so much junk that we hear out in our media of being in this business about hardware's not profitable, look at these margins decline. And as small business owners, as we're living day to day in our lives, we grasp onto these little nuggets of what look like truth. But then to sit in a room with nine of your peers and seven of them are saying, yeah, I get 22%, I get 24%. I'm like, you know, Eric Hansen in Southern California, I get 30%. Okay. When you see that, it starts breaking down those little barriers that we create for ourselves based on those snippets of information that we hear at a conference or that we hear elsewhere. And we can start seeing actual people do these things that we aspire to. And I can't tell you, you know, loudly enough that, you know, when we compare quarter over quarter each other's numbers when we meet to see that growth occur, to see somebody start at 6% service GP, I'm sorry, on hardware GP, and have that person grind their heels into the sand and face getting red, saying, nope, there's no way I can get 18% in my market. And then see next quarter, they got it up to 10%. And the quarter after that, they got it up to 15%. And the quarter after that, they've got it to 20%. I mean, that guy's happy. That guy's thrilled. He's happy to have been shown to be wrong by his peers. And you're not going to get that going to you know, a trade event once or twice a year where the group think is so thick that you can't get out of your own mind limitations.
Yeah, and I think it's again, you know, the products are all similar. Obviously, the people that are successful have worked out a method of doing that, and they've worked out a, you know, a pricing scheme, and the customers are happy to pay that. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, customers will pay whatever rate they feel solves their problem. So again, as long as you're solving the problem, you're able to sell the product or service into that. So again, I think it's a case of looking for those people in the peer group who are successful, who, you know, you can sit down and talk to and get that trust. So leading on to that is that obviously with the, you know, the business improvement groups that you run, I would see that the majority, the major issue most people would have with joining you know, a peer group like that is just the, you know, the trust factor is just the fear of, you know, I'm going to be exposing myself to all these people and laughed at, or, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing that. Is that something that you commonly see?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's that. And I have to tell you, just I love my job. I love that moment when somebody comes in and comes on board and they're nervous or scared or unsure about, you know, what it's going to look like to throw those numbers up on the projector and what the reaction is going to be. And to see, you know, 10 guys in our industry, and let's be honest, we all think pretty highly of ourselves, and we're usually the smartest guys in the room, you know, to actually have to get your numbers up on the projector and see these nine other guys do nothing but support you and not judge you and want to help you. I mean, there's different types of people in the world. Some people do really well working in a peer environment, and they like to be in the room, and they like to talk about ideas, and they like to engage with one another. And there's other people who they don't need that. They don't want that. That's not interesting to them. And fortunately, those are the people that don't join the groups, and they have their own path to success. And I love them. I wish them well. So, you know, just by the nature of sitting in that room, it's typically you're the personality type that thrives off of being in a group environment. So it just wouldn't even occur to you to be, you know, snarky or rude to somebody who may not be performing at the same level that you are. And the truth is, you're also sitting in that room because you want help. So very rarely do we have somebody come into this group who's just killing it on all fronts, who can sit there and stand in judgment of anyone else. So they're afraid, they're nervous in that first meeting. But you know, once you kind of expose your financial soul, you really start bonding with each other, and it's a really great environment that gets created between these guys.
Okay, so the peer group that you set up, or the peer group that people become involved with, is it a case that you match the, you know, the personalities, or is it a case that you match the business size, the revenues, or the expectation? I mean, how do you, I mean, is that there that sort of criteria, or is it you mix the, you know, the big and the small to get that sort of diversity? How do you, you know, go about crafting a, you know, a group for people?
Well, that you've just touched upon our one of our biggest challenges. When we have so many groups, and most of them are filled to capacity, but when somebody indicates that they'd like to join a group, we get a company profile on them, and we try to place them appropriately. Now, there's times when, you know, somebody is more successful than most, their revenue size is bigger, their employee size is bigger, and, you know, they don't really want to be sitting in a room with a bunch of guys who are kind of starting out and just getting their legs about them. There's other times when that highly successful person wants to be in the room with them because it kind of reminds them of their roots a little bit, and they like passing on that knowledge and getting a refresher. Because those guys who are a little more successful, maybe they're getting into my age group and they're 40 or 45 years old. Well, to be sitting, you know, in the same room with a 24-year-old who's, you know, getting some good momentum, that can re-energize them a little bit. So placing somebody into an existing group, yes, we go through a pretty, you know, extensive, you know, where would this person fit best type of equation. When we're starting a brand new group from scratch, we say, come one, come all, come to the first meeting, see if it's a good fit for you. If that group wasn't a right fit for you, let's see if we can't place you somewhere else within our mix.
And is it a case that, you know, as your business grows or as your personality changes or the business focus changes, do you migrate? Are you able to migrate between groups as required? Or do you tend to, you know, once you lock in a group of associates or a group of peers, you sort of ride them, you know, ride with them all the way through? Or is it something that you, you know, swap and change depending on the experience and the feedback that you want?
Right. That's you're tapping. I don't know if you've been tapping our phones or what, Robert, but these are the exact discussions we're having at Taylor Business Group. What we've seen historically is that people want to stay within their group forever. When we get that occasional request to say, hey, look, I love these guys in my group, but I'd like to meet with somebody more my own size, we have a place to put you. What we're toying with right now is coming up with a little bit of a path to say this is our, you know, highest performing group. This is the group for people who have met these minimum thresholds and criteria. And if you'd like to join it, you certainly can. But what we're kind of afraid of is that these guys have bonded so tightly with each other that leave, you know, it's kind of what's more important to them, that connection and that bond with their group, or being in a like-sized setting with other people who have achieved what they've achieved.
But do you run the risk of that, you know, I would think that in a business environment, you know, for most people who are looking to achieve, it's a matter of, you know, being pushed outside your comfort zone, being pushed to the next level. If you end up in a peer group and it's great and it gets you to a level, isn't there a risk that it stagnates? Everybody becomes a bit, you know, too friendly, a bit too comfortable with everybody, and they're, oh, you know, look, we're not going to push this person because, you know, either we've been around with them for a couple of years. Whereas, you know, a more uncomfortable environment, somebody who's more demanding, who's more, you know, driven, perhaps would push you to that next level. Would you think that is something that needs to happen rather than it just falling into this, you know, familiarity of the same people, you know, the same sort of opinions? And do you run the risk of, as an example, in the technology side, if you could get a group of people who say, let's say they're all focused on the MSP, the hardware, the infrastructure, well, you know, the cloud stuff's coming along, like it or not, and these people may, you know, negate the fact that it's ever going to have an impact. And by you being involved in that group who are potentially, you know, that you've built a strong bond with, who are then saying, well, no, cloud, no, do you run the risk of not getting a broad enough, you know, horizon?
Well, that is a phenomenal observation, and that is exactly what differentiates Taylor Business Group from many of its competitors in this arena. You know, that in some other competing peer groups, they are peer led, and what we've heard on the peer led side is that's exactly what happens. It gets very groupthinkish. At Taylor Business Group, you're always being proctored or guided by someone, you know, who's outside of the peer group, such as myself or Larry Scholes or Jeff Rozovsky. It's always led by somebody who is going to continue to make you uncomfortable. So if they're not making each other uncomfortable, we will most certainly make them uncomfortable. If somebody is not meeting the objectives that they've set forth for themselves, they will be accountable not only to the group, but to ourselves, or to, you know, in this case, myself. So we push. Now, the other side of this is these guys meet twice a year for a day and a half, which is great, because they don't become so comfortable with each other that they start thinking like each other. They still continue to bring their own views of the world. If we were to meet 4 times a year, 6 times a year, the conversation just gets a little too stagnant. So we've tried to keep ours to 2 times a year, and then they meet for a conference call for a couple of hours in between those meetings. But that challenge that you described is pretty much lays squarely on my shoulders to keep it fresh and uncomfortable and dynamic so that we don't get into that kind of rut.
Okay. Now, the other thing with the, obviously with the business group is it just about business? Do you guys sit down and talk about, you know, the implementation of, you know, ConnectWise or Autotask, or is it all about, you know, the numbers, all about hitting the numbers, all about growing the business, all about making the revenue? Is it, you know, how do you actually, like I said, cover the technology side of it and specifically focus on the, you know, the technology business and how to grow that as a whole, or is it just mainly the figures, the numbers, the metrics?
Right. Well, the meeting is broken down in a few different areas. So we spend a half a day just on the numbers, and it is strictly about grinding into the numbers, making sure you know your numbers, making sure you know how you compare to the benchmark, or how you compare to your peers. And that's a very laser focused conversation like you will find nowhere else in the world. In the rest of the meeting, that's when we go to our agenda of talking about 2 special topics. So the group decides what 2 special topics they'd like to cover in that meeting. Some examples might be the implication of cloud services on your business, the implication of marketing for your business. What are you doing for pricing managed services? They decide which special topics they want to discuss. And then we let, you know, those who feel like they've got a better handle on that discussion bring all their material. Show us what you're doing. Show us what's working for them. And the side note is, if it's working for you, it better be reflected in your P&L that we spent half a day reviewing. The next part of what we do in that meeting is called the business presentation. So 2 members of the group will take about an hour and a half or 2 hours and present their business to us as their board of advisors. So they'll go over a brief overview of their company, discuss any challenges or successes they've had in the last 6 months, and any types of things that they're thinking about tackling in the next 6 months. And then they just get tons of feedback from the group challenging them on what it exactly is they're doing, why they're doing it, why they continue to do it. You know, an example would be at one of my last meetings I had, there's a gentleman who was going to get married, and he was going to move about 500 miles away from his business. And he thought, well, I'll just start another business where it is I'll be moving, and I'll remotely manage my existing business. And you should have seen this group. I mean, this guy could, you know, you couldn't ask for better feedback. And in the end, he squashed the idea of opening that second location because the group just flat out told him, you're barely managing what you have. Why are you going to start another business? So that's where we get, you know, pretty heavy with one another. And then finally, the third part of the meeting is the objective setting and objective review. So at the end of the meeting, you're going to come up with 3 objectives of what you're going to accomplish before we meet again. And they're very specific. So you share what your next objectives are, and you went over how you did on the objectives you had set the last time. And that's a very powerful part of the meeting as well, because you're getting a reality check. You know, if you say, hey, I want to add $1,200 a month of new managed services revenue for each of the next 6 months, well, there's going to be somebody in that room who has done it or has tried to do that, has been able to do it or not been able to do it, and you're going to get that reality check to say, okay, let's dial that back down, or that's not aggressive enough. So you get that kind of peer review against those things that you want to be doing in your business. Okay. It's not just about the numbers.
Okay. So is the business group only for business owners?
At this time, it is strictly for business owners. We do have a new group that just started for service managers, and they'll be meeting for their first time here next Thursday and Friday. The last week of March, second to last week of March here in 2011. So that's going to be very exciting for us. It's hard to do business improvement groups for non-owners just because there is a little bit of transitory nature. And so the bonds don't get created quite as deeply when we have, if you have a service manager and he's involved in the group for 9 months and then he happens to leave, now you've got a void and everyone misses that person. So right now we focus mostly on owners.
Okay. All right. So we're drawing to the end of our time today, and just wondering if you can give us a bit of a wrap up, obviously on the important points that obviously a listener would take away. I think that typically the person listening will not be involved in a business group. So if you can give them the spiel of why that's a benefit and what benefits you've seen of people who have been involved in that, and also obviously the importance of getting the P&L up to date and in such a format that it's easy for you to pull out those key metrics. So if you can give us a bit of a roundup on those two topics, I think the listeners appreciate that.
Oh, by all means. So coming back to the P&L, I'd really like anybody who's listening to this to focus on four or five key metrics on the P&L, and I'll give you exactly what those metrics are. I want 8.5% net operating profit minimum. I want your G&A or your administrative expenses to be no more than 15% of your total revenue. I'd like for your sales expenses, that's commissions, salaries, and any marketing advertising, to be no more than 10% of your total revenue. Like your service gross profitability to be at least 55%, and your service salaries to be no more than 33% of your service revenue. Those are the benchmarks that we need you to be able to get. And if you can't get those numbers within, 2 to 10 minutes of looking at your P&L, you might want to consider upgrading your chart of accounts to something like we would recommend. So that's on the P&L side of the house. On the business improvement group and on the business improvement group side of the house, I obviously want everyone to join our groups. We bring tremendous value to people's businesses. The group really is about those 10 members. We're simply there to make sure it stays on task, provide some additional accountability, and make sure that these meetings get done in the most professional, efficient manner as possible. But even if you just hate Taylor Business Group, you don't want to be involved with Taylor Business Group, go find our competition and join a group. If you even remotely think that you would thrive in a group environment, go join one. Don't delay. It's going to change your life. It's going to change your business to be able to get with those peers and understand what the rest of the world is doing. The big difference is when you go to a conference, when you go to a workshop, when you go to a trade show, you hear a lot of hype, you hear a lot of BS, you hear a lot of bragging, you hear a lot of nonsense. Those same folks who are talking big, when they get in that room and their numbers on the board, you get a lot better information from them. It's not a lot of what I would do or what I could do or what you should do. It's this is what I'm doing. These are the results. Help me figure out how to do it better based on you doing it better. So that's my big push for it.
And I think, like I said, the extent is that the experience I've seen is generally most technology resellers tend to see themselves as a bit of an island. And as you say, they like to consider themselves the smartest people in the room technically, but their business skills are probably not as finely honed. They haven't had that that wide experience that they should have, and unfortunately they do consider that their business and their business skills are quite productive and profitable and they're doing quite well until some sort of event comes along, like a sickness or an unexpected accident or something throws them and the reality is thrown bare. So I think the big message is that you've got the professional peer groups that hold you accountable and are the top of the level, but even below that you've got other groups that other peers that you can be involved with one-on-one, and they're, like you said, I think the thing is that most people seem to think that they want to keep it all to themselves, but there's so many people out there in the community that will want to help and assist you and give you the benefit of their experience for nothing. It's just a matter of taking advantage of it. But again, there's probably not, you know, a lot of people that do. They go to the conference, like I said, they talk big and they, you know, feel that they have to compete with other people are there. But again, maybe creating a network of people that, you know, you can rely on, you can talk to one-on-one outside these sort of environments is going to be a better option.
Couldn't agree more once again, Robert.
Okay, well, that's great. I think that there's been a huge amount of information, you know, across for listeners today, and we appreciate the time that you've taken out to share that with us, Josh. But to round us off for today, if someone wants to get in contact with you about what you've discussed today or about Taylor Business Groups, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, let me drive you to one of three places. You can go to taylorbusinessgroup.com. You can email me at josh@taylorbusinessgroup.com, or you can reach me through my blog at jo-sh.com. Any one of those three ways, and you're going to get a hold of us, and we'll see if there's something we can't do for you.
Well, that's excellent. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Josh for his time today and hope that we can get him back sometime in the future to discuss any future needs and topics that people raise. So once again, Josh, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, Robert, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with your listeners.
No problems. And thank you, everybody, for listening to the Need to Know podcast. Keep in tune for future episodes. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.